for that kind introduction, and more importantly, thank you, Judith and Wendy, for your leadership on this issue. It is truly inspiring to me to see a group come together to take action so quickly. I know this wasn't necessarily on the top of everybody's agenda when the nation sort of faced this crisis in an important time in our history, but you stepped up to the plate, and I really appreciate it. I do apologize that I didn't more quickly respond to your initial inquiry. That was without a doubt the most busy time of my life. I was actually in the middle of, in addition to dealing with media and all that kind of business, getting out a book that we put together a book. We started the day after Newtown, and within 40 days we had the book in the hands of every member of Congress. And it's something I'm very proud of. It's also something I didn't sleep over about a 40-day period. So I had a lot of catching up to do. My task here is no small one. I'm going to, as rapidly as I can, and I apologize, I'm going to go pretty quickly through some of this, give you an overview. What do we know about how to prevent gun violence in the United States? And I'm going to cover a lot of different types of approaches to this in a very short amount of time, but we will have time at the end for questions. I have no relationships to disclose, so we can get to the topic. So here's the overall punchline. We can prevent gun violence. To some people, that's rather shocking. There's a lot of cynicism in this country about whether this is actually something that is an achievable goal. There are a lot of approaches that work, but an important sort of sub-theme is it's not just what you do, but how you do it. So implementation on all accounts matters an incredible amount. So many people working on this problem sort of think of it as an economist does. There's a demand side for illegal guns and there's a supply side. And I'm going to very quickly talk about demand and supply, at least how I think about it. So one approach is trying to discourage illegal gun carrying. This has been a tactic that was first tested in the mid-90s and retried in a number of places, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. And special police units go into places where the shootings are most concentrated. They focus on identifying people who are illegally carrying guns. They enforce minor crimes, violations of minor crimes, and will do pat-downs. There's been five fairly rigorous trials of this. This is at the neighborhood level. Four of them shown pretty substantial reductions in gun violence. And then now a sixth one more recently in Baltimore, as part of another study I was doing, we also found significant reductions in gun violence associated with this approach. The key question here really is, can this be done fairly and in a way that does not profile, and where the goal is more deterrence on carrying guns as opposed to incarceration. So in cities where great care has been taken to make sure this is done right, it has been done right with great community approval, but there have been other cases in which that has not been the case. So that's sort of what remains to be seen, I think, now in 2014 and moving forward is this can reduce gun violence, but can it be done fairly? That's the big question. So another strategy that you can put in the same sort of category of reducing demand for illegal guns is something called focused deterrence, a strategy popularized by criminologist David Kennedy, and now has been tried in a large number of cities in the United States and elsewhere. This is a far more focused strategy. Rather than focus just on an area with a lot of shootings, it focuses on the highest risk individuals who are believed to be generating a lot of that gun violence. And the idea here is that they are ready, willing, and able to apply sanctions, in essence, for committing gun violence, but that's not really what they want to do. What they want to do is deter. And so to get that deterrent effect, that's very important. The communication part, very direct to the individuals involved. And they also not only used law enforcement in this, but what sociologists would refer to as informal social controls through various outreach efforts to try to identify who will these high-risk individuals most respond to. They're also offered services, whether it's help getting jobs, or in some cases even relocations if they themselves are at high risk for being targeted with violence. And more recently, these initiatives focus just as much on the fairness that is perceived as a fair approach. And that is really kind of important meaning for lasting change, because there's lots of theory that is backed up by data that people will not comply with laws if they don't think they're fair. So that's an important part of it. So there was a meta-analysis published in 2012. 11 of 11 studies showed beneficial effects in the intervention group, the effects in the medium to large range. Those interventions that focused very specifically on gang and gun violence had the largest effects and all significantly reduced gun violence. Another approach that will be talked about in more detail in the subsequent talk is one now known as the Cure Violence Strategy, developed by Gary Slutkin and his colleagues at University of Illinois Chicago. Key components of this intervention are outreach to the high-risk individuals with what are known as credible messengers. These often are individuals who have been involved in illegal activities before. But they can, most importantly, they can connect with the high-risk individuals, promote social nonviolent norms, mediate conflicts, which is really central to its reduction of gun violence. There's been studies done and published now in four cities. Chicago is where the most data is because that's where the program has been in place for the longest period of time. Wesley Scogan and his colleagues looked at seven sites. Four of the seven showed clear, significant beneficial effects in reducing gun violence. In a study that I led in Baltimore, we first looked at five communities where this was put into place. Four dropped out because of implementation problems, but three of the remaining four that implemented it did see significant reductions in one or more forms of gun violence. In Crown Heights, New York, there was also evidence compared to a control group where gun violence increased that they had a slight decline in Crown Heights that was statistically significant in comparison to the control group. And in a very recently published study in Phoenix that didn't have the best control group, unfortunately, they did show reductions in violence, but somewhat oddly and sort of inexplicable, more shootings, less violence, more shootings. I'm not sure what to make of that right now, but I think one thing that sort of you can read the closer you get to this program and the research in it is that there are a number of implementation challenges with getting the right workers, the right oversight and management of what really can be thought of as underground activity, challenges with funding, and strained relations with law enforcement. Maybe we'll get into this again in more detail in our next talk. So the keys on the supply side to reducing the supply of illegal guns comes down to sort of two main ideas. One is, what standards do you have for legal gun ownership, and what means do you have to hold people accountable so that they don't illegally transfer their guns to those who are prohibited? Very briefly, Kate Vittes and some of our colleagues at Johns Hopkins published a study where we looked at the legal status of people convicted for gun crimes who are incarcerated in state prisons for the 13 states with the weakest standards. What we found was that only 40% of those individuals were prohibited. The most important part is this red slice of the pie. Almost 30% would have been prohibited had they been in a state with stricter standards for legal gun ownership, giving some hint of the potential for higher standards having an effect on gun violence. But does expanding these prohibitions to more high-risk individuals work? Well, we have some data on this in three categories. The first, in the domestic violence arena, restraining orders for domestic violence, policies that restrict firearm purchase and possession have been shown to significantly reduce intimate partner homicides in three published studies, anywhere from 8 to 19% reductions in intimate partner homicides. We also know that expanding prohibitions to violent misdemeanors also is associated with a reduction in violence, 21% reduction in a study done by Garen Wintemute and colleagues. And in one of the chapters in the book we published, led by Jeffrey Swanson, his team found that getting records into the system for background checks for those who were prohibited due to severe mental illness did reduce violent offending by almost half in the group affected. Now, what about these accountability policies? What do we know about them? Well, first, very briefly, we know in the most direct way how criminals get guns based upon surveys. Now, this is a little bit old data, and I'd be curious what our data would look like now and how much the internet pops up into this whole equation. But based on data from 2004, nearly 80% acquired their gun through some private transaction, either it was with friends or a family member or in some underground source. 6% said they got it through an illegal transaction with a licensed gun dealer, and 10% said they got it due to theft. So what's important, though, is not simply the most direct way that they got the gun, but the important channels for how guns get into this underground market and into the hands of people who will transfer them to criminals. Looking at data from the ATF, both in terms of gun trafficking investigations as well as crime gun traces, it appears that there are three main channels for diversion into that illegal market. These are licensed dealers who are either very blatantly violating laws or very negligent in how they run their businesses, straw purchasers who purchase guns for prohibited persons, or what ATF refers to as unlicensed sellers. These are people who buy and sell a lot of guns but don't bother to get a license. That was made easier by Congress almost 30 years ago now. Let me just jump in very quickly to what do we know about these channels. Crackdowns on problematic gun dealers has significantly reduced diversion in three different cities that we've studied. These policies, looking at permit to purchase licensing, background checks for all gun sales, dealer regulation, and mandatory theft and loss reporting, all have shown some reductions in some one or more studies in reducing gun violence. I'm going to quickly go through a couple more slides. I know I'm getting to the end of my time. What do we know with background checks and gun deaths? Well, there was an early study showing that there was no differences in reductions in homicides and suicides in states that had to have new background checks as a result of Brady. But we also have data showing that stronger background check policies, which is what we're striving for, in a study published in 2013 in a cross-sectional study, showed lower rates of firearm homicide and firearm suicide associated with these policies, but we don't know about the cause of the direction because it was a cross-sectional study. My own study recently published looked at a change that occurred in Missouri when it had comprehensive background checks and permit to purchase licensing system for handguns, and they repealed that in August of 2007. What we found is an immediate twofold increase in the diversion of guns to criminals. We also simultaneously saw an increase in guns that criminals were getting from in-state dealers versus out-of-state dealers. We saw their murder rates diverge from the national rate. Here you can see the yellow line from Missouri versus U.S. And our bottom line is we found anywhere from a 14% to 25% increase in murders or homicides associated with this policy change, with no change in firearm homicide rates. We now have data from a very similar study of a very similar policy, this one being adopted rather than repealed in Connecticut. And here again, we see very strong effects, estimated 40% reduction in gun homicide rates associated with this. Finally, we also know, and perhaps important to this group, is child access prevention laws have been found to reduce not only unintentional shooting deaths, but also reduce suicides. In our study, we found an 8% reduction in these policies. But to my amazement, I don't think there has been a state adopt such a policy in roughly 20 years. So the research priorities going forward is we need to know more about basically the strength of the background check laws and the ability to hold people accountable. We don't know enough about that. How does the underground market adapt to policy changes? We need to know more about best practices for policing on guns and most effective ways to promote nonviolent norms. Okay, over my time, I apologize. So, our next speaker is Charles Randall. Charles Ransford, Jr. Charles is a senior researcher with Cure Violence, a strategic public health initiative to support community-based and citywide gun violence prevention. He's been responsible for advancing the theoretical basis for Cure Violence model and preventing violence, and he also conducts research on the effectiveness of the model, drafts program-related materials, and helps improve data collection and contributes to the development and evolution of the model. Charles, you're up.
Thank you.